This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
For years, I was so fed up with shampoo, I just stopped washing my hair. I quit completely. I was so sick of poofy, frizzy, limp hair, distorting my natural oils. Until a few months ago, I found Modern Mammals, and it changed everything. And by the way, right now you can visit modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. So check that out. So look, I heard about this through the podcast, and before I agreed to advertise, they sent it to me and I was reluctant. But let me tell you, I should not have been. This stuff is absolutely magical. My hair felt better, smelled way better, and most importantly, looked better. And I know it will do the same for you as well. It doesn't have those hair-ruining chemicals like other products, and it doesn't leave any leftover residues. It works. Don't believe me? Go read their awesome reviews online as well. Go to modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code LSS. Don't forget to use our promo code LSS so they know we sent you.
Hello there. Welcome to another episode of the podcast, Lead Singer Syndrome. Whether it's your first time checking out the show, welcome. Maybe you've listened to all 100 and almost 50 episodes of the show. Also, welcome. I feel great right now. I feel great. I just landed in Germany, flew over the pond to do an awesome, awesome tour with my band Silverstein. We are coming over to do a co-headlining tour with our friends in Anti-Flag. Friends, just a band that I love, and this is just so, I'm so excited, you know? I think, you know, we've been off the road for a couple months, and I've been doing a lot of, you know, personal things, and I got a house, which is, you know, exciting, and been working on that. But of course, you know, at my core, I'm a musician. I'm a rocker. I was born to rock. I don't know. But seriously, it does feel good to be back on the road with a band that I remember seeing. I remember seeing Anti-Flag when I was in high school, and I just remember them being so intense and making me feel something, you know, and being this kind of angsty teenager and feeling this energy that I've never felt before when I listened to a punk rock band. So it's amazing it's come full circle. And I always wonder, how old was Chris Number Two at that show? He must have only been, he's only a year or two older than me. So it's kind of crazy to think about that. But I look forward to this tour. If you're in Europe, where are we playing? Germany, Austria, Belgium, Netherlands. There's also like some cool festivals we're doing with some really cool bands jumping on. There's one with Millencolin in a few days. Less Than Jake's playing a couple shows. Sam I Am. We're playing with Sam I Am, if you can believe it. So definitely if you're in Europe, check out the dates. They are online. Go to SilversteinMusic.com. Google it. You'll find the shows. You'll find the tickets. I can't wait to see you. Hey, this week's episode, it's a good one. I talked to a band. They're a newer band, but they just put out a really, really great album that a lot of people are calling a game changer. The band is Boston Manor. The guy is Henry Cox, the lead singer. Thank you to Henry for taking the time on a busy tour day to chat with me. It was wonderful speaking with him. And it's a great episode. Very honest, very open, and definitely a band I'm sure you know, but if you don't, check them out. Before we get into that, a couple things I want to remind you of. You know, the business of the show. The business being, if you want to email me, if you want to get in touch, it's real easy. I read all my email. It is leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. You can literally just say, hey, Shane, you're doing a great job. Or maybe your intros sort of suck. You need to improve on those. Maybe you have suggestions for upcoming guests of the show. Whatever you're feeling, hit me up on email, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com again, or I'm on social media at Shane Told, and the show is at Lead Singer Syn, S-Y-N, on Twitter, and at Lead Singer Syndrome on Instagram. So yes, do all of those things, all those wonderful things. And I know I talked about the Europeans and some stuff I'm doing here where I currently am standing on the earth. But in November and December, Silverstein will be doing an extensive U.S. tour. Some couple Canadian dates peppered in for good measure. And that is a tour we are playing our entire first record, When Broken is Easily Fixed, from start to finish. Also with the second greatest hit set. Yep, it's going to be a long show. It's going to be a good one. We're bringing out Hawthorne Heights and As Cities Burn, as well as a newer band called The Capstan to play with us. And yeah, tickets are flying off the shelves. Go get them now. A lot of the VIPs and stuff are sold out. A couple of the shows are sold out. Toronto just sold out, actually. But we added a second Toronto show at my favorite venue in Toronto, the Opera House. So if you're in Toronto, get tickets now. If you're in anywhere, get tickets now. They are flying off the shelf. If you want to help this show, we do have the All Access Club. Basically, it's more content. It's free stuff. It's not a lot of money per month, and it is what helps this show keep going and keep being free. The show will always be free, but the show does rely on people in the All Access Club, and you know who you are, and I know who you are, for the love, for the passion, and for a couple bucks every month just to keep this thing going. So I'll give you the link. It is leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. As low as $6 a month gets you in. And yeah, there's a lot of really nice perks you can get on there too, especially if one episode a week isn't enough for you, because for some people it's not. Some people, yeah, they've gone back, they've listened to all the episodes, and they're like, damn, I need more. Plus, I'm doing a good thing by supporting something that I really like. So I love it. Check it out again. Link, leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. All right. Well, hey, let's just go. Let's go into the conversation I had with a great new band and one you definitely need to check out. Here's my chat with Henry Cox of Boston Manor. I'll never say sorry, 'cause I'll never be free. You float like a butterfly, you sting like a bee. You're everywhere I go, you're always watching me. Get the hell out of my head, get the hell out of my head.
Hey, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, dude, loud and clear. How are you, man?
I'm good, thanks, mate. Yeah, really good. Is it too echoey in here? Is it all right?
No, it's fine, whatever. It's free content. What do you want? Right?
Yeah, exactly.
It can't be perfect. By the way, I do appreciate you doing this in the middle of a tour.
Oh, no worries, man. No worries. I'm really happy we get to do it.
Yeah, me too. But I mean, it's like 6 o'clock. You guys are gearing up for a show. Is it Glasgow tonight?
It is. Yeah. But we're not until like 9, so.
Cool. No, I mean, you know, everybody's different. I'm like the kind of guy that like shows up to a show like 15 minutes before I have to be on stage, like still wearing like whatever clothes I wore that day, like half drunk from a bar. And I'm just like, oh yeah, cool. Let's play. That's like, I'm just like that. Other people they need to be there like hours early. They need to get like mentally prepared. They need to warm up their voice. Which kind of person are you?
Well, what's funny is I think I'm the latter, but when I do the former, I'm way better. Like when I'm sitting there just kind of like, right, you know, just playing water and stretch and, you know, all this kind of shit, I'm like a bit more kind of in my head about things maybe.
Yeah.
And then I've
yeah.
definitely had a bunch of times where it's like festivals, exactly. You know, like you get woken up in the bus and you're like, oh, you're on in like 45, 30 minutes. I'm like, better get going. And then sometimes because I'm not thinking about it, like that's when I play the best.
It's true. And I find that, you know, speaking about festivals, it's almost the times when, let's say you got a festival, it's like in Germany or something. I know you guys have done, you did a lot of stuff that summer, this summer.
Exactly,
summer,
yeah.
Which, and like, so let's say you're going to play at like 6:30 and you're there and it's like 11 in the morning and you're like,
what the hell am I going to do for 7.5 hours?
Yeah.
And then you're just waiting and the anticipation like goes on and on and on. And I'm totally guilty of being, you know, getting in my own head. Totally. That totally can happen as a singer.
It's the worst thing for you as well. I've found like the number one thing that will affect how well you perform is just if you're anxious about it, tense up all your throat muscles, you kind of it, and then you just sound like shit. Whereas if you don't really give a fuck, it's at least for me, I can only speak for myself.
Yeah,
but.
Totally. No, the phone cut out just ever so slightly, but I definitely heard the gist. The people heard the gist, and you're right. And it's interesting too because as a singer, I feel like a big percentage of what you do is mental. And of course, there's a physical nature of it. Like, let's say you didn't get a lot of sleep last night, or you didn't drink that much water, or you're a little dehydrated, or your voice is like a little shot just from, you know, wear and tear.
Yeah.
I think that obviously that's important, but I think more than half is just your mental state. So,
yeah, I would 100% agree. And it took me a long time to learn that, actually. And I wish I'd learned it sooner. Because I spent a lot of the early part of our career just kind of like, I was super cautious and I wouldn't eat any alcohol or anything. And I'm still not a huge drinker. Like, you know, once I started kind of just relaxing and having fun, a lot of those kind of worries went away. And I still can't be stupid, but I have to like take care of myself. but yeah, once I started just kind of just chilling out, it came way easier. Because I think as soon as you start to get kind of anxious, and your muscles tense up slightly, it's game over, man, for me at least.
Yeah, no, totally. Well, I mean, let's talk about a couple days ago, London.
Yeah.
Biggest headline show to date. You're probably still riding the high from that a little bit.
It was crazy, mate, honestly. Like, it definitely won for the books. I won't forget that one in a hurry. It was crazy, you know, because we were like kind of got, you know, you get the tour route in through or whatever. And we were like, electric ballroom, really? That's a bit big, that. Like,
yeah, it's like 1,500 cap, right?
Yeah. I think they say it's that, but I think, I don't know, it might be slightly less, but around that, yeah. And it was fucking sick. Like, it didn't sell out, but it like packed. The crowd was amazing. It was just a wicked night, to be honest. And a bunch of our friends got to be there, so got to see it and stuff, which is cool. And we end this tour in Manchester, which is kind of, it was where we started playing gigs because there's no venues in our hometown. So it's almost like a hometown show as far as that goes.
Of course, yeah.
And that's like a venue that we love, and we've always seen like loads of big bands play there and stuff. So we're really excited for that one as well.
Totally. No, that's always a cool thing when you, like for me, and I'm from Toronto, and the venue here that I love is the Opera House. And that's, I'm sure you guys have been there before. And I mean, I don't know if it's like a great venue or whatever, but for me, it's my favorite because I saw all my favorite bands there as a kid. And I remember the first time I got to play on that stage and how much that meant to me. And that's something I think that, because at our core, we're all music fans. And that's why we do this.
Exactly.
So that is something that like never goes away. So which venue is that in Manchester?
I probably, because you know the Academy venues? Venues. I guess like the equivalent of like the House of Blues or something. But the Academy, there's like a bunch of them, Academy 1, 2, 3, and I think 4 in Manchester. But Academy 1 is like, I guess, the biggest one. And I think it's about 2.5 hours. In my head, because I was like really small when I started going there, it seems like a fucking arena just because I would have been tiny in these crowds. But it's probably about 2,500 cap. But all the kind of like, I thought the bands that I went to go see there were literally like the biggest bands on the planet. And I've seen like a million bands there. So I think we still haven't been lucky enough to play that venue yet. But I'm sure we'll get to at least support on that stage at some point. And it's not even like Manchester or anything. It's just like you say, it has kind of a sort of emotional connection, doesn't it?
Absolutely. No, I love that. I love that place. I love that street, man. You play in Manchester and you go to the Big Hands Bar and
it's a ritual.
Yeah, exactly. There's that little diner down the street beside the Greggs. I don't know. I always go there. And then the thing you got to do when you're in Manchester is you got to hit the Curry Mile.
Oh, this guy knows.
Oh, I bet you
that's
do.
What's
See,
up. No, I'm saying that's right. See, I'm saying it's sick. Like, not a lot of people hit the Curry Mile up, and it's the spot.
Oh, come on, dude. Yeah. Now, for people that don't know about the Curry Mile, basically, well, it's in Manchester, and it's like, I guess it's, I don't know if it's literally a mile, but it feels like it. And there's got to be like 100 Indian food restaurants like in a row on one street.
Yeah, it's in an area. I live in Manchester now, but I also I've just moved like in the last couple of weeks. But I went to university there before I moved home and stuff. Just past the Curry Mile, so I get a bus down to university every day through there. But it's like this whole area of South Manchester called Rush Home, which is, I guess, I want to say the 40s or 50s when there was a big wave of Asian immigrants coming in from like Pakistan and India and all that places. You know, they kind of formed a big community in this part of Manchester, and obviously business all kind of sort of thrived. And then there's this sort of, I could be wrong. I think they like national dish, Balti, which is a curry. And that's our national dish. And I think it was invented in Birmingham, with like the old, on that strip. I'm losing you a little bit.
Can you hear me okay? I'm losing you a little bit. It's just I think the Wi-Fi is a little spotty there in Glasgow.
I'm on my 4G, so I'm going to connect to the Wi-Fi now and see how we get on. But I'll keep talking.
Yeah, let's see if that's a little better. Yeah. We're just going to keep this rolling. I want people to know the pitfalls of what I do here. But
I could hear
the gist of what you were saying. I just for a second it was just getting a little jumbled. But you said there was some dish invented.
It was like
there, or something.
It's our national, the country's national dish is a curry. I think they invented it there. Right. Let me see if this Wi-Fi works. No. Sorry, carry on.
Oh, no, you're fine. I love like when you walk down that street and it's just like people standing outside their restaurants, like trying to convince you to come in to their food. You know, like we have the best naan bread. Like they're very they're very excited about Indian food. And I always go when I'm in Manchester. And that like plays back to the first thing we spoke about. The first thing we spoke about, how like, I'm like, oh, what? Let's go in. Just whatever. I'll be back at the show 15 minutes before. Get on stage. And sometimes I'm like, oh, damn, dude, I had like way too many papadoms or something, you know?
Oh yeah, mate. You can't be eating curry and then going straight on stage. That's a nightmare.
Oh, it's happened to me in Manchester. That's for sure, man. Dude. Well, you talked a little bit about your hometown of Blackpool.
Yeah.
And one thing that I read that I thought was kind of cool, and this is maybe a good segue into talking about your new record, is how you said it used to be called the Jewel of the North, and it was like this little mini, like, Las Vegas tourist, you know, kind of town.
Yeah.
You know, for your parents' generation, and for your generation growing up, it was a shithole.
It still is.
I mean, yeah, you know, and it still, exactly, still is. And how that played into the new record. And I mean, before we get to the new record and all that, talk to me about your upbringing a little bit in Blackpool and what it was like for you, you know, being a kid and how you got into music and stuff.
Yeah, well, I wasn't actually born in Blackpool. I moved there when I was like 2 or 3 years old or something. But it's a very weird place because, like you said, it was from the 40s. Maybe even from Victorian times up until like the 80s, it was like the tourist, the kind of vacation capital of the whole of the UK, really. And then cheap flights to like Spain became available. And so people were like, well, why would I sit on a beach in the rainy north of England when I could go to Spain or Italy or wherever else? So people started leaving and then the town sort of declined from that. But it's still got this crazy kind of tacky, like Atlantic City vibe about it, you know?
Right. I don't know if I've ever been there, but I almost picture if you've ever been to Niagara Falls.
Yeah, kind of.
That's, you know, very close to where I grew up.
Yeah. Because they're like stuck in between. Yeah, I read an article about that. But yeah, it's like that mixed with like Coney Island in the winter. If you can picture that.
Totally.
So it was okay. I was fortunate enough to grow up in like a suburb of Blackpool that wasn't too bad. It's since declined from where it was when I was like a kid. But my upbringing was great.
Okay. So that's why your parents moved to the suburbs there. Because, you know, the question is, obviously most people that are there probably are there because their family's there and they've been there for generations. Where did your family move from, and why did they choose an area like that that was, you know, declining?
Well, my mum was from that area anyway. My dad was actually from Birmingham. I was born in Birmingham area, and then we moved down there. And so my family's always kind of been from the suburbs. It's like, you know, 20 minutes from the center of Blackpool, but it's just, the neighborhood I live in isn't too rough. Although it has since kind of taken a bit of a turn, unfortunately. My parents are actually, just put their house up for sale, this week actually. So they're actually going to be leaving Blackpool for the first time in my whole life, which is kind of really weird. Yeah.
That's totally weird. Where are they going?
I don't know. I think north up county somewhere a little bit more rural. They've just retired. So I think they're kind of done with it all. And like I say, the area is kind of going really shitty. So I think they're like, let's get out of here sort of thing.
Yeah, no, that's always tough. You know, I'm lucky that my parents still live in the same house that I grew up in.
Oh, that's so cool.
There's a lot of familiarity. You know, I just go back and honestly, I'll just go in my basement corner and I have the coolest parents in the world. I know my mom listens to all my podcasts. So hi, mom. I have this basement, and it's this whole corner of the basement is just literally my shit that's been accumulating for not even kidding, 30 years. So I'll just go through and I'll find something. I found an old M-Box, which is a Pro Tools rig from 2002.
No
you know?
Way.
Like,
that's so
things
cool.
like that. You know, I'll just find in my basement that I forgot about.
I would love that.
So I would, you know, my parents still live there, which is great, especially because I grew up there and I still have some friends that live there. So it would be a little devastating for me if my parents moved and I'd be if they move far away, where I can't go back and visit and that house is gone. It's sort of a... Is there anything, are you going through anything like that, feeling with your parents?
I don't know, because...
imminent move?
A lot of my friends have all left. I only have a couple of friends. Uh-huh, yeah. Apart from the band, I only have a couple of friends who still live there. And I don't know, I thought I would do. My sister's kind of taking it a little bit harder. She's a bit younger. She's 5 years younger than me. And that's she's always lived there kind of thing her whole life. She's definitely finding it tough, but I am a little bit, but I know how much my parents are excited to have this kind of little place in the country that they've talked about pretty much my whole life. So I'm really stoked for them to kind of finally have retired and be able to do what they want to do.
Awesome.
And I'm kind of excited to start a bit of a new living in the city in Manchester will be cool. So,
very cool.
I'm pretty excited for it really. But although it will be kind of sad when we close the door for the final time, I'm sure.
I know. I'm sure it will be. So talk to me about your childhood. And you said you have a great childhood, great upbringing with your parents. You said you have one sister. How was it? How was music, viewed in the household? Are your parents musical? Your sister? How did you kind of get into this whole thing?
I always joke. My parents have such a terrible taste in music, both of them. And I'm sure they'll listen to this, and I'm sure they'll... lambast me for, but music was never
hello to the Coxes.
Music was never really in my it wasn't a huge part of my childhood per se, but I did a lot of acting and stuff in theater and youth theater and all that kind of stuff when I was a kid. So I guess I was in choirs and musical theater and all that kind of stuff when I was little, and then when I was about, I don't know, I started listening to hip-hop when I was 8 or 9, and then I got really into hip-hop. And just kind of went, it was obviously pre-computers and stuff, so just whatever CDs me and my friends could share, or I'd go and try and buy them, but they'd all be parental advisory, so the dude at the counter, Woolworths as it was then, wouldn't let you, would be how old are you? I'd be 15, and be nah, fuck off. And then
I don't remember that ever being a thing, having it, not being able to buy a record because of the sticker on it.
I don't think that was
ever an actual law, though, was it?
I don't know. I distinctly remember I tried to buy the Outkast double album, Speaker Box Love Below, wasn't allowed to buy that. I tried to buy a Wu-Tang Clan album. The dude at the counter wouldn't let me have that. And then, funnily enough, my cousin bought me a Method Man album. My mum saw it, heard some of the lyrics, and confiscated it. And literally a couple of months ago, or a year or something ago, she was like, I just found this in my cupboard. Do you want it? And I was like, yeah, sick. but when I got to about, I probably 11, 12, I guess, the start of high school is in the UK. my cousins started kind of showing me. I have older cousins who are between, I think, about 5 and 10 years older than me, maybe. And they started showing me, like, Slipknot. And it was, like, right in the height of kind of, like, the new metal era. Right? Well, towards the end of the new metal era, I would say, you know, early 2000s shit, you know, Korn and all that kind of stuff. And Linkin Park was a bit. Linkin Park was the first, like, rock CD I ever bought, I think.
Well, it makes sense because Linkin Park had some has some rap in it, right? So it's only a natural transition for you know somebody that's listened to rap to get into rock, or probably vice versa too. You
that's
know?
True. I never really thought about that, to be honest. But yeah, it makes total sense. It was Hybrid Theory had just come out, and I was like, yeah, this is sick. And yeah, so I kind of got into it through it there, and then it wasn't until I got to be about 14 or 15, and I had a few friends. We played like guitars and stuff, and I used to play the drums, and we would just practice in school in like shitty covers bands and stuff and just messing around. And then I was in
sorry,
a
the
band.
Phone cut out for a second. Did you say you were a drummer?
Yeah, sorry, man.
Oh, cool.
I'm on the Wi-Fi, but it's so crap.
No, it's been a lot better now. Okay. It's been a lot better now. Just that one word I didn't hear. So did you, did your parents let you get a drum kit, or how did that?
They compromised with an electric drum kit. I had drum lessons and stuff, and there's actually some pretty good facilities in my high school. Well, actually, it weren't that good thinking about it, but it was like a little drum room, and I used to every lunchtime just beat the shit out of the drums for an hour, and then came back to class, and then I would just play with my friends in kind of covers bands, just covering like I don't know Blink 182 and anything from that to like. Just Trivium, or trying to play Trivium anyway. anything
Matt,
we could
Matt
really.
Is a friend of the show. He you got to keep, if you want to be as good as Matt, you got to keep practicing.
I never will be. But we had a good go anyway. And then I guess my first, proper band, but band I actually played shows with was with a bunch of friends that I met from outside of school. And we kind of played, like used to get into our little cars when we were like 17 and play kind of slightly outside of Blackpool. We played some very terrible shows in Blackpool. There was never any venues, so we had to like, it's the age old story, isn't it? But we had to like play in pizza shops and, you know, churches and scout huts and all kinds of shit. And then it was one of those, I bet you remember, it was like, oh, you're in a band, you can play the show. Cool. So it'd be like anything from, you know, ska to like punk to metal to everything. It was kind of cool.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mixed as anything. So we used to just kind of do that. And then the shows would get real rowdy, be loads of moshing and stuff and craziness. And then obviously the owner wouldn't know anything about that. So they'd freak out and then they'd never let us. The police used to get called sometimes and they'd never let us play again. So we had to each show. Yeah. Each show.
New venue every show. Yeah.
Yeah. New place each show. that was that. And then. I played with those guys for like a year or so. I started singing then. That's I went on.
What was the name? What was the name of that band?
It was called Until Our Time. It was a
Until Our Time.
It was a Misery Signals lyric.
Oh, okay.
We took. But yeah, we were kind of like a sort of weird post-hardcore. But we had two singers though. It was that time when everybody had two singers. Do you remember that?
So were you the clean man?
More or less. Yeah, I did a little bit of the screamy stuff.
Mr. Clean.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, the clean and the screamer. Right, that was the vibe.
Well, that was a thing. That was a thing before, and people always said to me, "Oh, I was the first guy to do both." Which, if you listen to last week's episode with Nathan from Voice It's Fire, he was doing it in like the late '90s. But yeah, then all of a sudden it was like you got to have two guys. You got to have two.
That's so What's crazy. That I can't imagine. At that time, kind of, because now you know that, you know, there's a technique to screaming and that you can also sing, and it's, you know, there's voice coaches that can teach you that shit. But I guess for you back then, that would have been kind of like untrodden ground, right? Like,
I never took any lessons or anything until, you know, like we were on our second album, and I was like, maybe I can, you know, I got some money now, maybe I can afford this and like learn something and get better. But no, I never really learned anything from any.
You were kind of just making it up
just
as you
trial
went
and error, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just trial and error.
Respect. We played a show with Voice Sets Fire. Actually, I met those guys for the first time, this summer in, Europe. I think it was that same week I bumped into you in Germany. We did like one of their, they did like a one-off headliner in Cologne, and we opened for them. They were really nice
people. They're really, they're the best. They're some of our best friends. And it's cool. You know, they're like older guys. They're even older than we are. And, but we never knew them. Like, you know, it's not like we've known them from back in the day. We just met them like 3 years ago.
No way. That's so weird.
And,
are they,
and yeah. And we're just, and we just became like amazing friends, like right off the bat.
That's awesome. They're from like, what, yeah, like Delaware, Maryland, somewhere like that?
Yeah. They're from, yeah, they're from Delaware, like just outside Philadelphia. Yeah.
True. True. Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Yeah. No, nice people.
Yeah.
Because we obviously, we met, well, I say we kind of met then, because I don't think, we were both on Warped Tour, but I don't think I ever really really bumped into you guys much on the Warped Tour that summer.
Not really. I saw you guys kicking around, and we actually run in some of the same circles. Like, I have this in my list of questions here, you know, talking about the strength of your live show and how I think it's really played into, you know, the size of your band now.
Oh, thank
and we're
you,
jumping
man.
Around so much here. But I remember the reason I was thinking about this was because I remember you guys played a show in Toronto and I wasn't around for it. I was on tour or something, but everybody was talking about it. Like,
oh,
all my
great
friends in Toronto. And I'm not just talking about, you know, like, as you guys say, punters, like just, you know, kids at the shows. I'm like talking about friends, like people that are in bands or people that, you know, are doing DJ nights or whatever, you know, like scenesters. So everybody
awesome
was talking about your band, and I'd heard your name, but I was like, okay, this is something to like to keep watch for.
Thank you, man. That's really nice.
Yeah. So I mean, I was very aware of you guys, you know, being, you know, on Warped Tour, but we had our own fucking clique anyways, behind our trailer every day. Like,
oh, dude,
I was drunk the entire summer, so.
Yeah, you guys had it set up with the fake grass and the fucking...
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys were living. If I... Obviously, we'll never do Warped Tour again, but if I did, I would have been taking a leaf out of your book, I think, with that shit. Definitely.
Thank you. Thank you, man. So, I mean, I guess, like, I'm trying to segue into talking about this new record, Welcome to the Neighborhood.
Yeah,
which
cool.
Is it's, you know, to be honest, it's the reason I reached out to you to talk to you, because so many people, when your record came out, hit me up and was like, you got to get Henry on the show. This new record is amazing. It's such a departure. You know, I really want to hear what he has to say about this, because people seemingly overnight were just like obsessed with this album.
That's really nice to hear. Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, we've kind of seen that a little bit our end. It was a, because it's so different, it did. The response was great. Like, we could never have expected it to be that well received. But
well, were you scared that it was going to be totally the other opposite? Because that, I mean, there's all got to be a fear there.
Do you know what's funny? Because everyone says, don't they, that like your sophomore albums, like you have your whole life to make your first record, and then, you know, a year to make your second.
Yeah,
we were kind of, but it was weirdly, it was the other way around for us, because the whole first record was so kind of, like, in our own heads about it. We're like, oh, you know, we just signed to this record label, and if it's shit, like, they'll just drop us. We're like an international band, you know, like, we can't fuck up, and people want us to be this pop punk band and all this.
Right.
So we were kind of freaking out about that. And then when we started writing the second album, we kind of just decided what we wanted to do, what kind of band we wanted to be, and just got so, like, involved in the creative process, and just kind of were just so enjoying making music that we completely forgot that people actually were going to listen to it. And it was only like literally like 2 weeks before the album was due to come out, you know, and they were gearing up all the, or I guess the singles were going to drop. And I was like, oh fuck, like people might not actually like this shit. but fortunately, I haven't heard much backlash at all, but obviously it is like really, really different from our previous stuff. So we were conscious of it for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I mean, that's my next question. Was it a natural progression, or did you guys say, okay, we want to make a record like this, we want to make a darker, more gloomy record, or did it just, when you started writing the songs, it just sort of came that direction, like went that direction and you went with it?
Kind of both in a way, because we definitely kind of, because it had been about 3 years in between writing both records. And in that time, you know, we kind of all started to kind of share our musical, you know, what we were listening to, and go back to what we grew up listening to, which was like Deftones and, you know, Korn and Nine Inch Nails is a big one and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, God, I love Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, dude, my favorite band, yeah. And so we kind of went back through that stuff. But then I went back and listened to our first record fairly recently, and I was like, this sounds nothing like how we play it live. And I realized that we'd sort of been subconsciously kind of changing the sound of those songs live to be heavier and darker sounding, and, you know, changing the chords slightly and heavier vocal delivery and all that kind of stuff. So I think we're just gravitating towards making a heavier, sort of darker record. But we actually rewrote about 2/3 of the album like a month before we went to the studio.
Yeah. Well, that's what, you know, I read, and it's like, I know you guys went over with Mike Sapone in America, and you guys did some pre-production and you were unhappy with it and scrapped it and did it again.
Yeah, more or less, man. We had like, I think we demoed about 10 or 11 songs. One of them we recorded properly, which became like a standalone single we did in between the two. And then we kept, I'd say, a third of those, the stuff that we pre-prod. And then a lot of it, we were like, well, should we just keep working at this and improving it? And then we were like, well, nah, at its core, it just isn't really that good of a song. You know, I feel like the best songs you can boil down to just an acoustic guitar and you can just sing it and it should still sound good, right? And they were just kind of clunky and you know, whatever. And don't get me wrong, Sapone like polished those things up from where we walked in with them, but still it was just kind of not there, you know?
Yeah, well, it's interesting though, because it's kind of like making an entire album and not putting it out, at least, you know, creatively, right?
Oh yeah,
because nobody heard it, nobody heard that stuff. So in a way, like, you guys are sort of skipping a step. It's like if and I mean, there's no way you could ever do this, but like, let's say a band. Well, maybe you could if you went back and you were like, oh, I want to check out this band's first album, this band I've never heard of or heard before. And then I'm going to like skip album 2 and 3 and just listen to album 4 as if that's album number 2. You know what I mean?
Yeah, pretty much.
And you know, those subtle changes that go into a band over several albums or even one album, it can happen, you know, are normal. But for you guys, it's kind of like, boom, new band, who dis, you know, like you guys, because there was a step that you went through that nobody heard those songs. So I find that, you know, kind of interesting too, that could be why
I think,
you know,
you're right.
There's a change, you know.
I didn't think about that, but I think you're absolutely right. Like, I think going back and listening to those demos, it probably was somewhere in between the two records.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I'm glad that we did what we did. And I think a lot of it was like, we had these influences and we knew we wanted to kind of put some like industrial sounds and more electronic element in it and explore, like flirt with hip hop a little bit. And we were kind of dipping our toe in a little bit, and then Sapone kind of just pushed us in and was like, just fucking do it. If you want to like...
Yeah.
You know, really indulge yourself in these sounds, then just do it. Don't like kind of think about what it means in respect to your previous music. Just make the songs that you want to make. And I'm really glad we did. And now I just can't wait to get back into the studio and start writing again. Like, we're already kind of sharing some ideas for some new music. So it's
all right. Well, we won't even talk about the record. It's over. It's out. it's out. On to the next. Well, you know, you mentioned the sophomore slump, which is something we've talked about on the show, like, in great depth. I've talked with so many artists about it because it's a real thing. And I always say, if you can name a band that put out a bad second album and still made a career out of it, go ahead, because I can't think of one.
Yeah, you stumped me.
And you know what's funny is, I think if I were to write a book on how to make a sophomore album. Like, if, you know, let's just say how to make a sophomore album, you know, punk rock band 101, right?
Yeah.
What would I tell them? And I would definitely not say to do what you did. And another band that had a very, very successful second album was Brand New.
Exactly.
With Deja Entendu. And what's interesting about that is that's the same producer, Mike Sapone.
He
recorded Deja Entendu, and he also recorded your new album.
He did, yeah.
Do you think, I mean, even subconsciously, I mean, I'm sure you're aware of what he's done and probably part of why you worked with him. Do you think that played into your either your conscious or unconscious mind at all? That was a record that, you know, holds a lot of weight and always will, no matter what, you know, with Jesse Lacey and the allegations and all that, it will always hold weight, just musically.
Oh yeah. So it's funny, cause we always loved Brandy's music, grew up with that. And we had this kind of idea of what Sapone's going to be like before we met him. Cause he's very private. You know, he like, we have the only photo of him with a band on the internet. He allowed us to take a picture with him when we finished recording and put it up.
Okay.
But
loads of
other bands were like hitting us up, like, "How did you get Sapone to take a photo with you?" But he's super secretive. He won't, you know, he just likes to kind of keep himself on the down low. So we thought of him coming, you know, brand new, because they're like a very mysterious like band and stuff. And we thought he'd be this very serious guy. And he's literally he's fucking awesome. But he's like a cartoon character. He's like your like cool uncle or I don't know, you're like your friend's older brother or something. He's like, he's just this super like Long Island sounding dude, he's like a mad scientist, and he just gets so hyper and excited. And there's one point where in the studio, we were kind of almost set up in different booths all facing into the control room. And he was like this mad conductor, and he was trying to explain to us like how a structure should go, and he was running up to the window and like gesticulating at us, and he was wicked. And he loves iced tea and White Castle, and I judge him for that. But he's a wicked dude. But it's funny that, you know, he was nothing like I pictured him. But when he gets into the nitty gritty, and you're like, oh yeah, this dude made some incredible records, and I can see why. Like he has such a good ear, and he's just really creative. But I think we, I mean, maybe I'm speaking for him here, but I think we kind of found each other at a pretty cool time, because I think by that point when we started working with him, Brand New had ended and all that stuff. But also he'd obviously done a lot of like, you know, emo stuff with Taking Back Sunday and I guess like bands like McCafferty and the Excerpts and stuff. And we'd obviously always been in this kind of like pop punk, I guess, pigeonhole, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then we kind of came to him and said we wanted to do this totally different thing. And he is a huge Nine Inch Nails fan, and he loves like stuff like Aphex Twin and Brian Eno and all this like crazy synth stuff. And he has all this synth equipment, analog synth stuff from the 80s and 90s. And it was one of the first times he's ever got to just go nuts with it. So like brought it all in. And I think we both kind of found each other at a really cool time, because we would just sit there and play with all these toys for like hours. You know, it was great.
That's cool. What's your favorite Nine Inch Nails record?
Honestly, it's probably Downward Spiral, but I'm really, really into Pretty Hate Machine. Like,
I
love, it's just like an anti-80s pop record. I'm going to go with Pretty Hate Machine, you know.
Yeah.
It's got
it's,
more
it's
bangers
my favorite.
On it.
Yeah, it's my favorite. And I remember I heard the record, I'm old, so I heard the record before Broken came out.
Oh, holy shit, yeah.
And my sister, you know, I'm lucky that I have a sister that's 7 years older than me that liked awesome music.
Cool.
So she got me into so much of this stuff. And I actually had a Nine Inch Nails Pretty Hate Machine shirt that I wore in my fourth grade class picture.
Dude, that is so cool.
And they were my favorite band when I was in grade four. And I remember this is so funny, and I've never mentioned this, and I haven't even thought about it probably since it happened, but I think I was in fifth grade and we were like learning how to use computers. And when I was in fifth grade, how old are you in fifth grade? Like
I don't know.
Nine?
It's different here, but yeah, I guess.
No, maybe older, maybe 10, maybe you're like 10. So I'm like 10 years old. So this is like 1991. So computers aren't like, we got these like little Mac, whatever. All the nerds will be shouting at the radio what kind of Macs they had back then or whatever. But so we're literally just learning how to like just type and print stuff out, you know. And I remember I typed out lyrics for Something I Can Never Have.
Oh, cool.
Which, for people that don't know, is like a super drawn out like ballad,
intense,
very
song,
very
yeah.
very intense song. And I remember I wrote it all in lowercase letters, because that's the way it was in the liner notes of the Pretty Hate Machine CD booklet. So I wrote it out like that, and I like printed it out, and I just was like sitting with my stuff, and my teacher found it and like pulled me aside with the principal and like asked if I was like,
no
okay.
way. That's crazy.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
were way and, cooler than I was at 10. That is sick. That is so
and
cool.
And then what was funny was when Nine Inch Nails Broken came out, which is a very heavy record compared to Pretty Hate Machine, I was like, because that was right about when I was starting to get into metal and stuff like that. And
perfect timing. You know,
yeah, and I was like, this is crazy. And yeah, for me, I'd say at that time, they were absolutely my favorite band, and Downward Spiral is amazing. I'd say, I don't know, ever after Downward Spiral, I think I got too punk rock or something for the band.
Feel you,
but
I
respect Nine Inch Nails, and I'd say as a lyricist, one of my biggest influences.
Yeah, me too, man. Reznor's up there. I'm a big fan of like the With Teeth record. I like the new stuff as well, yeah. But that record, Year Zero, was one of the first examples of like viral marketing. And I read a whole piece on like all the things they did for that, and it's super, really, really cool. They're just a really I suppose it's kind of pretty much just Trent and now Atticus Ross, but they're a really, really creative group of people. And I watched that documentary again recently. What's it called? The Defiant Ones. Did you see that?
No, I haven't seen it. No.
Oh, mate, you got to see that. It's wicked.
I have to.
Yeah, it's fantastic. There's a whole, obviously, it's the whole history of both Dr. Dre, but also Interscope Records, and they signed Nine Inch Nails from Broken onwards, they interviewed Trent Reznor, and the whole history of how he kind of launched Marilyn Manson's career and all that kind of stuff is super, super interesting.
Funny. I actually didn't know that he had a hand in launching Marilyn Manson's career, but I did see it was 1994. I saw it was a co-headline show: Soundgarden and Nine Inch Nails, and Marilyn Manson opened.
Oh my God, that's insane. What a bill. Yeah, he signed Manson to Nothing Records, which is his label imprint and he actually produced his first four records, if I'm not mistaken.
What? I can't believe I didn't know that. Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. Crazy.
You can hear in like all the instrumentation of the first couple albums that he's just a big Nine Inch Nails fan, like Manson is.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. There's you can hear the similarities. Crazy, man. So yeah, and a little while back, I'm switching gears a little bit, but you said how, you know, you're kind of on to the next thing, and I was reading in a couple of other interviews and stuff you did, and you said that you thought it was arrogant when bands say, you know, that they've found their sound. And even though in a way you guys have found your sound currently, it's kind of amazing self-awareness that you have that in like a year and a half, you're gonna have to do this all again.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
right. But you're aware of that, and it's like, we found our sound. Like, I guess we've found our sound, but we found it like now. For now, we've temporarily sort of found its sound. Definitely. I think that's very interesting.
Maybe it's optimism, because I would hate to think that my second album I ever write is you know my best. I would want us to, you know, continually improve with each record that we write, or I guess that's the ideal thing that would happen. But yeah, I think like saying you found your sound, I do think it is a bit like, oh yeah, you know, like we nailed it. But I think we definitely on this record, like narrowed it down. You know, we're way closer in the ballpark to where we want to be. I wouldn't say we found it. And I think we're going to keep it. I think it's all a part of your kind of lifespan as an artist to keep creating and trying different things. Maybe you never find sound, who knows, but I think we're definitely like in the region that we want to be, and I think album three won't be nearly as different, like it won't be that enormous jump that album one was to two. I wouldn't have thought, but I mean, you know, who knows where we'll be at in a couple of years, but that would be my best guess, you know?
Yeah, I mean, who knows?
Maybe, I mean, like, what do you think? I mean, you've, I mean, how many records are still being put out now? Sorry, I'm not that clued up.
I forget sometimes too. We've done eight.
Eight? Holy shit, that's sick.
Yeah.
So, like, what do you think is where? What do you think is? Because I always think about this, right? You've got eight records. And you can't exactly say that they're all exactly as good as each other. And obviously you'll have a personal preference for different reasons.
Yeah.
But do you think has there ever been a record where you've been like, that wasn't as good as like the last one. Like, we'll have to do better on the next one. Cause obviously I've only done two albums, so it's hard for me to get to that. Do you know what I mean?
And absolutely. And I think every time you make a record, you have to believe in it, and you have to believe that this is the best shit you're capable of. I think for us, at least, because we do spend the time and we do put in the work, and I think a lot of bands, when they start getting up to record number, let's say even five, but like once you get to like six, seven, eight records, I think a lot of bands they become like legacy acts, and their you know best days are so far behind them, and they're not even playing some of the new material live. that starts happening to bands where I think, and time becomes different. People have families, people value their time off the road. So I think that creatively things get stifled and we're aware of that. We're aware of that. So every time we do a record, a new record, it's like, okay, we got to go harder. We got to spend more time on this. We got to be,
that's sick.
So I think that that's important. So every step of the way we've done that. I don't want to talk too much about myself. This is your interview, but but honestly though, there has been times where we've made missteps. Like our third record was kind of a misstep, and I think our fifth album maybe was a little bit too. And every time we've done that, we've come back with something that was more ambitious, and then it became for us more successful. Both to our fans and creatively. But you know, when you've been a band as long as we have and put out records every 2 years, you're going to have some missteps, and I think we're lucky we haven't had too many.
Yeah, well, dude, when I was talking to you guys in Germany about it and stuff, because I've obviously known Silverstein my whole life of listening to rock. Most of it, again, I would imagine. I'm 25, but when I kind of got into the whole kind of post-hardcore, like Sun Fire, all that kind of shit. Obviously, Silverstein was a huge part of that kind of world. But I mean, not kissing your ass or anything, but I never ever thought of you guys as like an older band, but like I was definitely not a legacy band, because it still seems that you guys are like in the throw of releasing good shit, and it's not like, oh, play that one song from, we only want to hear that one song from album two or whatever. You definitely seem to be a band that's kind of like doing new shit and cool shit, which is really sick.
Thank you, man. That's nice of you to say. Yeah, we've still embraced our past. I mean, shit, to plug our tour that's happening later this year, we're doing a 15-year anniversary of our first album, playing the album from start to finish.
So
we still do stuff like that, but then our latest record, Dead Reflection, was like by far the most well-received record we've ever put out. And to with press and with fans and everything. So to do that on album number eight, but we put the work in, and we that's the key.
I totally agree. Like we wrote for like a whole year for this album. Ironically, then ended up writing most of it in 1 month. But it took us that time of just grinding, and because it's not like one dude with a guitar who kind of writes the songs and then's like, here we go, this is what we're doing. It's always totally collaborative, all five of us. And it does, I'm not sure how you guys write, but it takes us like, I think for us, it makes us write better songs, but it takes us definitely longer than I can imagine it would do.
So do you guys do the old school, like y'all get in a room and you jam?
No, we do a lot of it on kind of, we all get in the same house, and then we kind of do some of it. We'll like record stuff into Pro Tools. So what we did on this record was like, a lot of them I would come with like a vocal hook in a chorus and some lyrics. And I would try and get the best possible like catchy chorus that kind of fit this theme that I was going to expand on. And then we would write that chorus, and then we just kind of pass it around, and we end up with like three or four song ideas on the go at once. And you've got people in each room, and they're just kind of passing the songs between each other, adding, guitar, and then Jordan put the drums in, and then we start to kind of mess with the structure. And I always think of it as almost like a human body, like start off with a skeleton, then, put some meat on the bones, put some skin on, and then, that's the whole package. But,
Totally. Yeah. It's weird though. Like talking to someone like Vic from Pierce the Veil, when they make records, they literally do the entire record with music, and they haven't even thought about the vocals.
That's nuts to me.
And they just put the vocals like on after, and he's like, I'm paraphrasing, and I'd have to go, I did podcast a while back, but, that's pretty much, he said, if the music is going to work, then putting vocals over it, vocal melodies over the music, it'll work. And that's how we do it. And I was taken aback too, because there's definitely, I think, people always ask, like the number one thing people ask is, what do you write first, the music or the lyrics? And I'm always like, well, the music comes first, but like you still need to kind of think about the lyrics,
or
the vocal melodies, like the vocal parts, while you're writing. But to start with a vocal melody and a chorus, it doesn't seem to me like that's the skeleton. That seems like that's like maybe the organs.
maybe you're right.
But it's a different sort of approach for sure.
But sometimes though, it is just a riff, like um, like the second track on the album, we just have this kind of riff, and we're like, right, that riff will just run all the
way
through
the title?
Verses.
What's the title for
flowers,
people to
Flowers in Your Dustbin? It's just got that like dan, and we had that. And then this track, If I Can't Have It, No One Can, I wanted this like kind of trash talk kind of sounding just bass riff, like this track called Exile on Broadway, and I kind of wanted that. But we started off just with this.
Oh, hello, I'm losing you.
Nah,
I'm losing you, brother. Oh, hang on. Yeah? Oh, you there? Yeah, it just cut out for a second. I heard Exile on Broadway, and then it cut out.
Yeah, yeah. I just wanted this. There's a track by Trash Talk called Exile on Broadway, and it has this kind of just dirty bass riff all the way through. And I wanted working, but we added from there and added from there. So sometimes I'll like, you know, the chorus just kind of comes on last. And I suppose he's right, because sometimes you just hear a riff and you're like, boom, got the chorus there, easy.
Yeah,
but I can't imagine like writing a whole record and then putting the vocals on. That's nuts. Because Pierce the Veil's like super catchy and shit, isn't it? So I don't know how.
I mean, Vic is amazing. And maybe even subconsciously, you're still like thinking about the vocals kind of. But I mean, it's always kind of like the same. And you're a guitar player too, I guess. A little bit?
No, I can't play guitar, actually.
Oh, you don't play guitar? I mean, that's okay. But, you know, what I always like liken it to is you have like a chord progression, you know, like whether it's a chorus or verse, whatever, and you want to put a lead over it. You can always write a lead over a chorus.
Yeah, I guess
Over a chord progression. So putting vocals over something, it's no different really than just putting a lead guitar over something. You know,
I think the key is to not clutter the music too much, so you leave room for those vocals. Like, make sure that there's not like crazy shit going on all the way through, because then it leaves nowhere for the vocals to sit. But if you just got like just great rhythm guitar and either put the lead on after, or you're not. I mean, everybody's different, but I've definitely tried to write to songs where there's so much going on and it's almost distracting, and you can't quite kind of figure out a vocal melody. But maybe that's just me. I don't know.
Well, that happens for sure, especially if you're talking about a chorus specifically, because what inevitably happens is, because you don't record the vocals first, usually, you know, you'll have some lead guitar over a chorus, then it'll come time to put the vocals on, and when the thing gets mixed, that lead guitar that was so cool that someone worked so hard on is so buried in the mix that you can't even really hear what it's doing.
Exactly.
Because you need the the vocals to be, they're the most important part of a chorus, I'd say. I mean, I think this is lead singer syndrome, but I think that everyone would agree with us.
Sure,
at least in a chorus, that the vocals are the most important thing. So, yeah, I think that's a good point, man. It's a really good point.
I mean, it's opponent it a lot with us, but you'll get to the studio and it'll be that bit that you've been listening to for months, you know, on the demos, and it's the sickest bit, but it's detrimental to the song, and you just got to kill it. We call it like killing your babies. Because the song part's your baby. I mean, so you know, you bring that part to the table, and you love it, and you're like, oh, you're killing my lead, you're killing my baby, and you're like, it's gotta go, it's messing with the song. But if it's for the, you know, it's for the greater good, isn't it?
Absolutely, man. Well, hey, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you have a show tonight in Glasgow, Scotland. Drink some scotch for me.
Yeah,
I'm a big scotch fan.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm going to drink a lot of Iron Brew. If you ever had that, it's the best shit in the world.
Iron Brew? No, I don't even know.
You
what
never
it
tried
is.
That?
I don't,
oh, dude,
think,
you got
it. What is it?
It's like
beer?
A soda. No, it's a soda, but it's just like it's fucking. It's the best. It's my favorite soda in the world. It's like orange, and I can't describe what it tastes like. It's kind of like orange soda, but more kind of tangy. I don't know, but it's like they have like shelves of it in the supermarkets here.
I can't believe I've never heard. Is it? It's not alcoholic.
No.
Oh, it's just a regular, like,
yeah,
a
it's
pop,
just a soda,
we
yeah.
call them.
Pop,
we
yeah.
call them pop.
Oh, Canadian.
Well, where
pop,
I live,
yeah.
we call them pop, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, dude, I don't want to take too much time. I got a couple fan questions, if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course.
And I'll let you
right.
go. Is that cool?
Absolutely.
Let me see what we didn't already cover here. This is from Neil Anglin. He's a big fan of the show. He says, others are consistently creating meaningful discussions with their... Oh shit! I'm reading from Facebook. Sorry. He says, where does he see the band in regards to the recent surge of UK bands breaking out? Does he think they're better than the rest, or is there a band that stands out from the group to him as well as Boston Manor?
I don't know. We're lucky to kind of be a British band at the time that we are, because I feel like there was a whole crop of really good British bands that about maybe 5 years before us that never really broke into kind of North America, and I think it just was like a bad timing thing. But you know, bands like bands like Neck Deep kind of paved the way in terms of British bands, I think, and shone a bit of the limelight on us. So there's a bunch of British bands that are killing it right now. You know, like Trashboat, who I know you guys know, are doing. Started touring America, and they're doing awesome stuff. And there's a whole host. I think the main thing is going to be is like, as long as bands keep kind of pushing the envelope and pushing the boundaries. Progressing and keep pushing through, because I think particularly with some of the bands like Movements, who are blowing up right now, like they're bringing something to the table that you know, you don't hear a lot at the moment. It's definitely new to the listeners that are you know, they're fans and stuff, and that's why part of the reason that they're doing so great is because they're bringing something fresh, and that's the main thing. I just and maybe it's just from on a personal level, but I just really don't like when you know that something's being rehashed at you. So I think those bands that are particularly British bands, because we have to compete with America, which is hard because it's way more expensive to tour America. We've got to get over there, and we have to pay like so much money for visas and stuff. And it's tough. So you got to work pretty hard to break America as a British band. So hard work's a big one, but I think bands that just keep doing cool shit are the British bands that you're going to see kind of still doing shit in the next, you know, 2-3 years time.
There you go. Thank you for the answer. And last question here from Derek James. What inspired the song Halo?
Halo. Okay, so it's a song. It's basically just a song about addiction, right? Yeah, it's just about addiction, and I use the kind of metaphors of heroin addiction because, one, kind of strong history, but two, because it is indicative of a problem that Blackpool has, where I'm from. You know, there's at one point it was the heroin capital of England, so it's definitely had those problems. But I just kind of it's supposed to be indicative of addiction as a whole. You know, whether that is a toxic relationship, whether it is, you know, addiction to even social media, right? Anything. You know, right. I think that's rife in society in all forms. So it isn't, contrary to popular belief, I have not had a problem with heroin. I just use that as a metaphor or a simile, whichever one of the two that is.
Yeah, one or the other. Who knows?
One of those things. Yeah.
I was too busy writing Nine Inch Nails lyrics on my notebook to remember the differences between simile and metaphor. Right. that's great, man. Thank you so much. So tell the people what you got coming up. Obviously. This is probably by the time this comes out, your UK tour will be done, but you got some American dates with Real Friends coming up, and then what else?
We do, yeah. We got some of the full US with Real Friends, which is going to be a lot of fun, playing a lot of stuff off the new album. Then we go straight from there, don't even go home. We go to Japan to do some headline shows in Japan. I've never been there before, so I'm buzzing for that.
Oh, you're going to love it. You're going
to
love it.
I can't wait. So we're going to do that, and then we go straight from there to do Good Things Festival in Australia? And we've never been there either, so
beautiful, this is great.
Yeah, we're
this
really
is great.
Excited.
You guys have lots of cool you know, notches on the belt to
yeah, definitely
punch.
I can't wait. Yes. We're very lucky.
Great.
And that takes us up to Christmas pretty much.
Yeah, and any plans for next year? I'm sure there are, but you can't talk about them.
Yeah. So we're doing a big European tour in February. I think it's been kind of floating around, but they're kind of fixing some details of that, and it's going to get, I guess,
announced soon.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not still sure what's going on with that, but we're doing that in February. That's a full Europe run, and I think there's a couple of UK shows on that. And then we do have some more plans, but obviously, like, you know, nothing announced yet. So stay tuned and keep your eyes peeled, because I'm sure in the next sort of month or two, more of those tours will get announced. But it's we're going to be busy until this time next year, I think.
Well, dude, thank you, man. Henry, thank you so much for taking the time on a busy show day to do this.
No, it was a pleasure. Thank you for the, you know, the great conversation, Shane. I appreciate it.
Yes, I appreciate that you spelled neighborhood correctly.
Hey.
obviously, if you didn't, you would have got the most backlash ever from, you know.
Yeah, we had to tell, I said to Pure Noise, I was like, right, make sure that you just spell it right, please, because we'll look like idiots otherwise.
Someone's going to take autocorrect and they're going to, that stupid red line's going to go under. And then, you know, you're going to be like, that's not the way you spell neighborhood. Exactly. And then the press release is going to go out. It's going to be a mess.
I was legit like worrying about that at one point. I had to really like make it clear. I was like, I know it doesn't seem important, but like it is to us. Like, please make sure it's spelled the UK way, and Canadian way.
Yes, yeah, no, we're with you guys. We love you.
And God save the Queen.
There you go. We got the Queen on our money. We know what's up.
Exactly. Yeah. Monarchy and stuff.
Isn't it weird that one day, maybe, I mean, you're English, but isn't it weird that one day, I hope it's not too soon, but you know, how old's the Queen?
Oh, like a million
gonna
die, years old.
Yeah, and then they're going to start putting Prince King Charles on the money?
Yeah.
That's going to be so weird to think about that.
I don't want
to
see him on my money. Like the Queen's an endearing figure. Just Charles's mug all over my like wallet. I'm not down for that.
I think, but that's what's going to happen, right?
It is, isn't it? It is. And we'll have to change the song as well. Our national anthem. You got to change one word. I mean, it's only one word, but I've been singing God Save the Queen all my life. Now I've got to sing God Save the King. It's crazy.
I guess that happens. Yeah, that's so fucking weird. Oh, well, hey.
Oh, well, all right, there you go.
Well, dude, I'll let you go, man. Thank you so much. Let me ask you something, though, real quick. I always play music at the end of the show. What song do you want people to hear from the new record?
Oh, from the new record. I guess a song that we haven't done on singles. So try Funeral Party, I reckon.
Funeral Party. That sounds uplifting. Let's here it is, Funeral Party by Boston Manor on Lead Singer Syndrome. Thank you, Henry. All the best.
Cheers,
man.
Mate. Thanks very much.
Give me something to
So there's Funeral Party by Boston Manor, one of many of great song on their new album. Be sure to check out the whole thing. It is on the streaming services. And of course, if you want to really go nuts, there's vinyl. There's probably even cassette tapes, which is crazy that that's back, right? Cassette tapes. Shout out to my buddy Brian for sending me some Lagwagon merch. I'm currently rocking a shirt right now. He even sent me Lagwagon's Hoss on cassette, which, I mean, I don't know if I'm ever going to actually listen to it, to be honest with you, but I guess it's cool. I've got it on vinyl. I've got it on CD. So now I have it on cassette to complete the trifecta. Hey, next week, we will be back, as always, with some really great episodes of some, you know, we have a great mix of new bands, medium length bands, I don't know how to even word that, and of course, some all-time greats, as always, on the show. I love it. Please, if you like the show, help spread the word, tell a friend, tell a loved one, write a review on iTunes, do what you want, do what you gotta do to help me out and help this thing going, so we can get to, how many episodes should we do? I mean, I'm at 150. I think I could easily get this thing up to a solid quadruple digits. It'll take me a while. That's many years. But I love this thing, and I don't think I'm ever going to run out of lead singers. If I do, I'll just come back around and talk to them all again. Anyways, thanks so much for tuning in. I'll see you next time. Peace and love.